audit. We're getting ready to deliver recommendations to the Climate Action Council. So we're, our official work is close to complete, but we do have you all on speed dial. So I just hope you're willing to continue to be available as the Climate Action Council continues the process of developing the scoping plan. Your input really has been incredibly valuable, and I know we're going to want to keep tapping you going forward. So you can't escape. You're committed for life. I also want to take just a moment to thank the staff working group led by Paul Beyer and Brad Tito, and just want to thank you all for the incredible amount of work you've put in throughout this process, and you definitely can't escape. You'll be working on this for the foreseeable future. So thanks, everyone, and if I can have the next slide, please. So today, we're really going to focus on our proposed recommendations, but we'll start with some updates. So we'll do some quick updates. It's been 6 weeks since our last meeting, so we have a bunch to talk about. Then we'll move on to the land use, clean energy, and carbon sequestration recommendations. That'll be the majority of our meeting today. Those are the ones that we're going to deliver to the Climate Action Council at their May 10th meeting. Adaptation and resilience is on a more extended timeline, so we'll reserve a more detailed review of those recommendations for our next and final panel meeting, which is on May 4th. Did I get that right? Okay, May 4th. Mark Lowry will correct me if I'm wrong. Okay, so next slide, please. Can I the next slide? Oh, and even the next one. Thanks. So since our last meeting, which was about 6 weeks ago, which was a long pause for us as a panel, there has been a tremendous amount of activity at various levels. And I think, as you all know, we've been working together sort of to further develop and refine our recommendations. So lots of you have participated in subgroup meetings over the past 6 weeks. And many of you have also provided comments individually and have joined sort of small ad hoc discussions by email and phone. We've also held some cross-panel meetings with other panels, including ag and forestry, transportation, and power generation. During those, we've discussed areas of mutual concern and sort of further developed our respective recommendations. And the results of all of this are reflected in the recommendations that we will review later today. And of course, the staff working group continues to meet to provide feedback, technical assistance, and other support to the advisory panel. Next slide, please.
All right.
So throughout this process, we've endeavored to, Josh, I was just going to introduce you. We've endeavored to invite input from a broad audience to inform and enhance the panel's work. I just wanted to ask Josh Hun, who's been sort of managing a lot of this process, to give a brief overview of this process so far.
Thank you, sir. I'm excited just to kind of provide a recap of, you know, where we've been as far as public engagement for the Land Use and Local Government Advisory Panel. As Sarah mentioned, we've been really busy since our last panel meeting on February 22nd, expanding the reach of our public engagement efforts. This is our 9th advisory panel meeting today, and all these meetings have been open to the public. We've been collecting feedback from the chat after each of these, and compiling that feedback for review by the panel. We've also held a second local government roundtable event on March 2nd, where we were joined by 18 local government representatives from across the state, and they provided a number of really great feedback items that we've used to advise the draft recommendations that will be presented today. And on March 8th, we held a dedicated public engagement session that was intended to hear verbal comments from the general public on our clean energy, land use, and carbon sequestration recommendations. And again, we received really great feedback there. On April 8th, Mark Lowry held a similar engagement session focused on the adaptation and resilience initiatives. And just in total, we've received over 100 public comments via chat and email. These have been supplemented with, again, that local government roundtable feedback, results from our online stakeholder survey, And all this has just helped to guide our deliberations and the development of recommendations. So now I'll hand it back to Sarah. Oh, I think you're on mute, Sarah.
Thank you, Josh. Yep. Never learn. I will never learn. It's been over a year. So I did say, we'll have an in-depth discussion of the adaptation resilience recommendations at the next meeting, but Mark does have an update, so I'm going to hand it over to Mark to give sort of a brief update of where that process is and get everyone excited for the next meeting. So, Mark, it's all you.
Don't make me responsible for exciting people, but I will give an update. Next slide, please. Thank you, Sarah. So for those of you who joined the April 8th public session that we held specifically on the adaptation and resilience recommendations, you may recall that I have gone ahead and divided the 11 initiatives that we have so far, with perhaps a 12th in the making, the 11 that we currently have, into three themes: one focused on building capacity, one on living systems, and next slide, please, the other focused on communities and infrastructure. I'm not going to go through all of these because they said I'm not allowed to take that much time, but these are all available on the public website, and all of the members of this advisory panel, as well as of the adaptation and resilience group, have access to the slides that we are preparing and essentially updating to document incoming information. Next slide, please. So for any members of the Adaptation Resilience Group, and again, that includes members of the land use, all members of the Land Use and Local Government Advisory Panel, plus staff and others that have volunteered or been volunteered to serve on the Adaptation Resilience Group, you have access to the SharePoint file. That is where we are essentially taking comment and input from that group on a rolling basis. For other members of the public, materials remain available at the Climate Action Council website. The materials that were posted for the April 8th public session, you are certainly welcome to review those and send any comments on the recommendations that are documented in that material, either via email to the Land Use and Local Government email, or if you prefer to send them in writing, you may do so, sending them to me directly. Because of the deadline we have to turn the adaptation and resilience recommendations over to the council, the comment deadline for the adaptation and resilience recommendations will be close of business May 7th, 2021. So that is coming up. Next slide, please. And just to put all of this into context a little more, the adaptation and resilience group will meet for what I think will be the final time next Wednesday, the 21st, for a final review of the adaptation resilience recommendations. I am currently working through a pile of comments that I received from various stakeholders and staff, and doing my best to incorporate those into the SharePoint file that we are using, and I'm hopeful that by Monday I'll be able to turn that around and send back to the members of the Adaptation Resilience Group updated slides incorporating that input. The this panel will meet again, presumably for the last time, on May 4th, with a focus on the adaptation and resilience recommendations or consideration that we're going to provide to the CAC. And what I'm hopeful that I'll be able to do is essentially a dry run, the presentation I will do for the council, because I, as a representative of this panel, I want to be sure that you folks, the panel members, are confident in saying, yes, Lowry is actually speaking on our behalf, and we concur with what he is presenting to the council. We will continue to take comments until the following Friday. So the 4th is, I think, a Tuesday. We'll continue to take comments on these recommendations through the 7th. But obviously, the earlier I get any additional comments or other input on those these recommendations, the greater your chances are that that input would be included in what is actually presented to the council. Our adaptation resilience recommendations are due to the council by May 14th, but we will not be presenting them until June 8th. So the Climate Action Council meeting scheduled for June 8th, which currently is scheduled to run from 2 to 5, I believe, will be focused on presentation of the adaptation resilience recommendations, along with those of the Climate Justice Working Group. And unless there are questions, I think that's all I have.
All right. Thanks, Mark. Are there any questions? Okay. All right. So as I mentioned earlier, we are going to spend the entire, most of this meeting just reviewing these recommendations. I have been invited to present our panel's recommendations to the Climate Action Council on May 10th. And it's really important that what's presented at that meeting does reflect the intentions of this panel. You all have put a lot of work into this, and we want to make sure that this represents the consensus. So our goal today is to get through all of these. We have a lot to review. In the interest of time, we're not going to read every word on the slides, but I do hope, I know you all have had these, have seen these before, and you have a copy. I hope you've had a chance to to review them, and we'll share comments or thoughts as we go through. The way we're going to do this is Paul, Brad, and Laura will each provide a brief overview, respectively of each recommendation, and then we'll pause after each individual recommendation for any comments or discussion, with the goal of spending about half an hour on each of the three sections. Land use is a little bit of a longer section, so we'll have a little more time on that. But we do need to, our goal is to be done by 3 o'clock, which is the time our meeting is over. So we're going to try to rush. We'll try to get through this. We don't have unlimited time, but if we do find some areas where that seem to require a little more in-depth discussion, I'm going to ask that we follow up after today's meeting. We're getting close to being done, but we really do need to finish up. But I just want to be able to get through the extensive slate of recommendations today. So if there's any areas that we just need to work on a little bit more, I will sort of ask that we do that in the coming day or couple of days. I also want to note that for clarity, we've attempted to highlight any significant changes from the previous iteration of slate of recommendations. So that's why you'll see the yellow on some of these slides. We may have missed some, so don't take the highlighting as gospel. It's sort of guidance and just to help folks understand these. And there are definitely word changes, various things that, folks have fixed grammar, chosen better words, all that. Those are not highlighted. So don't, it's not gospel. It's just sort of an attempt to sort of highlight some areas that we definitely want to point out are different. So I'll stop talking now and turn things over to Paul so we can get started on the land use recommendations.
Okay, thank you, Sarah. And I echo Sarah's gratitude to all of you for the work you put in. It's really a exciting way to do program development and public policy. So it has been a whirlwind, but it has been a pleasurable one. A couple of quick, next slide, please. So we have five overarching strategies. You've seen most of them. We, since the last meeting, bundled two of them because they really were overlapping in a lot of ways. Particularly the ones focused on comp planning and municipal assistance for smart growth planning. But after we contracted, we expanded and developed a separate strategy on transit-oriented development, which I'll get to at the end. Very important, energy-efficient topic that was peppered throughout our recommendations, and also the transportation panels deliberations, and we felt that it was warranted to pull them together. So I'll get into more detail on that later. We developed what we call impact slides that showed just transition impacts, health impacts, impacts on disadvantaged communities. They're in your slideshow, but we really don't have time to go in depth into them. But if you'd like to reference them or discuss them, please feel free to. The same with case studies. I pulled out about six or seven of what we thought were the most illustrative case studies, separate slides for each of them. I'm not going to run through them. You've seen them all already in different forms. But again, if you want to, we can. So with that said, just very quickly through the titles, and then we'll get into the exact nuts and bolts of each strategy. The first one is the big one, guiding future growth and development to where we want it, where we don't want it, based on comp planning, which could occur at the county or the regional scale. Next slide. Here's where we get into implementation, and that is how to get from planning to zoning to good projects. Next slide. Review and approval of beneficial projects. Again, we've talked about this before, just expediting the process without compromising input and deliberation. Four is aligning our priorities. This is a big one. This gets right to the core of state spending and how it can reinforce CLCPA goals. And again, number five is a way to focus policy and accelerate transit-oriented development, TOD. So those are the five. Next slide, we'll get, again, I'm not going to read all of these. This is the first one I just went over. This is the overview slide. You see a couple of the case studies that we called out in this slide. Next slide, please. And here's where we get a little more detailed. Again, you know, how can we perhaps align state funding and REDC funding and RED strategic priority projects and plans with the goals of CLCPA, but also those goals as reflected in existing regional sustainability plans, which are cover the entire state. How do we coordinate with the REDCs and the other regional entities that might help us align all these interests? On transportation, we were talking about maybe expanding the table at the MPOs, the Metropolitan Planning Organizations. But we're talking about alignment here, incentivizing comprehensive plans. We have a pilot project here at DOS on countywide resiliency planning, but it's bigger than that. It's it gets us to health impacts, and it's also a way to enhance county and municipal comp planning. Next slide. Huge here. There's a lot to play with. That's a big description there, and there's going to be far more detail. But how do we define and implement what we mean by priority development areas? Where do we want to focus our funding and our attention? And then where do we not want to grow? You've heard these two phrases before. Plenty of case studies out there. We think we can align state spending and policy with these two basic fundamental precepts of smart growth. Next slide. Let's see. Extending eligibility for some smart growth grants. Their regional planning councils do great work for us as regional coordinators, but in some cases they're not eligible for planning grants. We'd like to change that. Using our shared services programs and resources for intermunicipal planning. We see that particularly prevalent in rural communities, but how can we, you know, get more out of our planning through intermunicipal plan sharing planning services, really. Looking at 239 county review, if we're emphasizing county planning, maybe the counties could have more say in individual projects. The IDAs are an ally right now with us. I think it's a matter of accelerating their use of tax credits for smart, sustainable, equitable projects. Next slide. Okay, so that was land use one, probably the most overarching principle, gets right to smart growth. So I'm going to pause there to see what you have to say about it. this is probably the fifth or sixth time you've heard different iterations of this, but.
I have a couple comments. Thank you. I again commend the panel for all the work on this, and especially the staff for getting us to this point. It's really exciting to be almost there. I will be sharing some written comments on suggestions and questions to the Line by Line. But I also wanted to just share some of the broad questions now. One area of recommendations that I've been working on with some of my colleagues in the panel is related to the need to define a little bit, you know, what we mean with smart growth, and trying to define to the extent possible, really, how are we going to be anticipating some of the potential impacts on disadvantaged communities that you're listing in some of the slides. But that where I think we require a little more explicit language. For example, there's some instances where smart growth is obviously one of the main focuses of this. And this recommendation, I think, is, you know, a perfect example of it. But in some cases, you know, there seem to be opportunities to include other type of strategies that can go with it. One of the potential anticipated or unintended anticipated impacts of it has to do with potential gentrification that can come in connection to it. And so I'll point in my written comments some places where some of the language used, I think, could be strengthened to reflect that. But just in general, you know, in terms of the definition of smart growth, you know, I think that there are places where we can think about to what extent, you know, the particular recommendation is addressing the need of higher density communities. I think that, you know, the recommendation right now and is very much trying to address conditions of suburban communities upstate, and I think that that's great. But some of the questions that I'll share have to do with the extent to which this is responding to the needs of communities in higher density parts of the state. I'm thinking specifically big cities like New York City. These are places where you'll see in my comments there may be places where the infrastructure is in place for transit-oriented development, and where it's not, you know, I think that the recommendations will be useful in developing that infrastructure as part of the emphasis on disadvantaged communities. But there may be other places where that may already have the infrastructure in place and may already be dense. So I wonder, you know, whether the same framework that we're using almost exclusively centered on smart growth and transit-oriented development really applies there, or whether there's an opportunity to create another strategy or a sister a component to the strategy that addresses other types of priorities and other types of concerns that may apply for these types of neighborhoods. Again, higher density areas that are different from some suburban smaller density areas.
So Juan, just to clarify, I think you're talking about sort of smart growth. I mean, and when I think about smart growth, I think of it as more than just sort of intensifying development, you know, denser development is part of it, but it also includes other, you know, the full sort of range of sort of amenities and you know, that a community might need. So it's about, you know, sort of smart and healthy development, mixed use, access to public space, access to retail, you know, all of mixed use, mixed income, all of those things. So I think that's particularly relevant in more developed areas where you may already have even some of the density or the ability for more density, but the goal is not just building, you know, unit upon unit upon unit, but it's creating a healthy, sustainable place to live where folks can access everything they need sort of within a particular area. That's sort of what I think of when I think of smart growth. Is that sort of where you're going, is sort of maybe making that clearer in our recommendations, that we don't just mean let's build more and more and more. We mean let's build smartly and responsibly. Is that sort of in a way that is equitable and
thank you. Thank you for the clarification. I think that expanding a little bit on the definition of how the recommendations are understanding smart growth, I think that would be great. I think that there are other places where some of the language, for example, when we talk about the concentration of poverty, I think can reflect some of what you just explained in terms of, mm-hmm. you know, to what extent we're also on anticipating the potential for ground smart growth to actually result in gentrification. And to what extent, you know, is improving these amenities actually result in displacing places that are already dense, where the infrastructure may not be there, and therefore, you know, they need to be prioritized. Mm-hmm. Or where the infrastructure may be there, but they may have other concerns or priorities. And I'm thinking specifically about disadvantaged communities and environmental justice areas where the planning process may be, I think, overlapping with what you said, but in some cases may actually be different. Maybe not about increasing density vis-a-vis smart growth, but actually addressing some of these specific other things that you mentioned.
Okay. I think all of that makes sense. Do we maybe, you said you have some, you know, you've given some thought to specific language, so maybe this is a good follow-up?
Yes, absolutely.
And sort of a note going forward, I think it's a good flag, and I'm sure our panel, well, other folks can speak up, but I would imagine this is something that we're all, you know, everyone all interested in ensuring is part of our recommendations.
Thank you.
And we just want to make it as clear as possible. I need to say, not related to this, I just want to point out something. Josh Hun sent me and just sent me a little note that apparently we do not have the highlights in this version. I apologize. There have been some changes, and I know that Paul, Brad, and Laura will highlight where you know, anything that particularly should pay attention to, but there's no highlighting, so I apologize.
Yeah, thanks so much, Juan. The interesting thing about the smart growth movement is it started in a very simple concept. What attracted me to it, the three E's, not just balancing, but integrating equity into economy and jobs and the environment. But it's constantly evolving, and that's a good thing. So please, some more details. We tried to address displacement and gentrification in a recommendation that'll come up a little later. And what we pulled out, what I know to be three effective tools: the land banks, the land trusts, that shared equity model, and inclusionary incentivized zoning. But if there's more to that, please, you know, augment this, because we're going to get into far more detail moving forward. Okay, next strategy. Direct planning and zoning assistance to local governments. Next slide, please. And this is really getting to the need for, basically the need for more plans, particularly in communities that don't have the resources to develop them. We have examples of mini comp plans, expedited comp plans, that help us get to zoning and projects. And so this is the direct assistance that we're recommending. Simplify the process of accessing state funding that relates to land use planning. We have a recommendation later to align all the programs into some type of a guidebook, an online iterative guidebook. But here is a much broader recommendation to simply either to try to put as many programs into the consolidated funding application as possible, because that was the aspiration, to have them all in one place, but also to integrate them. But also for those programs that are not in, just find a way to help municipalities to access those programs more easily. One of the recommendations here, Juan, that came from discussion with you, some type of a centralized baseline database for municipalities. We can do it. We know it because Juan, you and I have exchanged case studies. I wrote a case study on what they do in the Boston metro area, what they do with Desegregate Connecticut. They have zoning atlases, really remarkable databases that communities can use to develop their comp plans and their zoning ordinances. And that's often the piece that is missing. What do we mean by comp plans? What should be in every comp plan? Next slide. Model local laws are always a big help. We have model resiliency laws. We have model solar siting laws. It may help us to have some compendium of model local laws for smart growth planning. The second one here we've talked about since the beginning, and that is expanding existing programs that can get to smart growth on the municipal, county, and regional level. Smart growth program here at DOS, certainly NYSERDA's clean energy coordinators, and now soon to come online, I believe, the DEC climate leadership coordinators, which has a land use planning component built into it. So it's this whole theme that is central to almost everything, and that's capacity building, technical assistance, resources, handholding. Next slide, please. Here we got the resource guidebook, a sustainable development guidebook. There's a prototype of sorts that we developed a few years ago, but we really feel like it would help to have some centralized place that even that these regional coordinators and agency staff can use, again, just to make it easier to link the programs up and access them. Next slide, please. And here is an open-ended recommendation to address displacement and gentrification and the concentration of poverty. I have a case study on a couple of one developer and one policy that I think really gets to that. But again, we'd like to explore all of the tools that are out there. And I just named really three of them here. So that's land use LU2, if you'd like to discuss.
I have some thoughts, but I can wait if others want to jump in.
I was just going to highlight, I think, how important the inclusion of the coordinated efforts to get resources and technical assistance for governments is. So I think this is looking really good, and I like the changes.
Yes, we appreciate your input on that, Jessica. I think that could go a long way. Juan?
Thank you so much for including the recommendations on the central database or central data set. The repository of databases or data sets. I wanted to highlight on that how the more that I learn about the New York Climate Science Clearinghouse, the more that I think that this could be sort of something that already exists, where I've heard directly from NYSERDA that they're very interested in partnering with other state agencies and updating that and expanding it to reflect the needs of what this panel and others may require. So I really encourage you to take a look at that and especially maybe to now the point of the recommendation to try to explicitly lay out what are the type of resources that will be produced, that will be incorporated there. I know that from
some conversations. When you finished recording, you may hang up.
We've talked about creating like a statewide land use layer that could go along with a statewide zoning coverage that, to my understanding, doesn't exist right now, to try to make the information available for some of the statewide projections, but at the same time, I think explicitly laying out what are the type of data products that will be created to support local and regional planning in that clearinghouse would be great. The other two comments, and I will expand again on my written comments, it have to do with some of the discussions that we had around the eligibility of some of the funding to include community-based organizations. And I know that you've listed them in certain places, but in some others, it may be useful to explicitly lay out, you know, where will they be specifically eligible, either as direct applicants or in partnership with local governments, etc. And then just finally, we've also talked a little bit about how the regional EKA, or how the CLCPA really has the potential to call for updates in the structure of agencies across the state. And specifically, we've talked about some of the limitations in the governance structure of the regional economic development councils and the mechanism through which their representatives are elected, and how to make sure that some of the equity goals of the CLCPA are reflected in terms of, you know, the diversity and the inclusiveness of those bodies in relation to the areas that they plan for. Again, just some high-level comments. I will be sharing with you like specific places where I think that some of this language, you know, could be laid out, or questions, suggestions for the staff.
Yeah, terrific. Thanks, Juan. Yeah, we've been talking about the REDCs too. I believe they all need to have one EJ representative, but there are a lot of them that really are not representative of the community that pulls together equity, sustainability, and jobs and economic development. And I think that's what we're trying to get to here somewhere, whether it lands at the REDC or is incorporated into the REDCs. Anything else? Okay, LU3. Please. And this really goes, next slide, please. This goes to the examples we've seen out there of how to assist, how to move the local process along. One of the big ones that we saw that I think is it can be really, really helpful is publicly supported generic environmental impact statements. Lay the groundwork for a smart, sustainable project to actually happen for the developer. And as we pointed out before in New Rochelle, they fund these GEISs. And if a developer comes in and takes advantage of it, they pay a fee back into this revolving fund. It seems to be a way to move the process along. It's also an open door to do more early and frequent outreach and education. Developers and municipal officials have said over and over again, you know, don't put people back on their heels. Give them time to learn and understand about a project. And that's where the second component here comes in. And it's shared with our friends on the transportation panel that all of this is going to take a massive outreach and education effort. State driven, but primarily locally driven, even project driven. Next slide, please. Oh, that was a short one. Okay, anything on LU3?
And I have a couple comments, but I can also wait to give other people a chance to speak first.
Anybody? Juan, the floor is yours.
Thank you. You know, this is a tricky one, and it's I, you know, commend the panel and the staff for, you know, all the work that has been done on this one, because it's a controversial one, and I'm glad that you've sort of updated some of the language that at some point including like track two proposals or alternatives. And I'm glad that, you know, we're sort of like in a little bit of a middle ground at this point. And I just more than anything had a question. So the GEISs, the idea is that they can operate like a citywide or a region-wide scale, so that the actual local review process can focus on some of the specific particular concerns of a project by project. Is am I understanding this correctly? So generating kind of like a baseline analysis that happens at a scale, at a higher scale, and only once, so that the actual review project by project can then focus on specific concerns. Is that a fair interpretation?
Yes, baseline analysis, setting the table, that is the best way for me to conceptualize a GEIS. There are other people on the phone here that I think can fill in the gaps if they'd like to. But the idea here is you have a good, let's say you take a district, an area around a train station, a downtown, and you have the proper overlay zoning in place, but you haven't done a full GEIS on what it would look like if the developer actually bought into these incentives, the affordability, density, the streetscape design, things like that. Rather than having them start from scratch, we'd have publicly supported baseline review for them. So you're right, Juan, when they come in and say, hey, we want to do this great project that checks all the boxes, affordability, green, equitable, then their next step will be simply zeroing in on the nuances, for lack of a better term. But we're basically setting the table for them. It's like another incentive. We're jump-starting the process.
Yeah. Thank you, Paul, for that. And this is again, just kind of like to highlight that this is, I think, a really interesting way of addressing the need to expedite the review process. I think it's very sound. I think that some of the suggestions that I'll make have to do with making sure that we explicitly laid out how to reinforce or re-strengthen the capacity, the local capacity to review whatever scope then will be used to focus that conversation, and what are the resources that local governments and local communities will have to carry out that review, either in the form of consultants, or I know we've talked a little bit about the intervener fund that is available through Article 10 and other resources that communities can actually apply for technical assistance, or the type of capacity that they can actually the resources to build the capacity to be able to actually carry out the review, but also what are some of the specific and you mentioned them, opportunities to strengthen the opportunities for community engagement. I also have questions about whether the reason why I say that is because I have questions about whether the type of a local review can also include ways to demonstrate local support, which could go along with, requiring that there are community groups, community grassroots organizations or coalitions demonstrating their support for the project, or the extent which they actually have been involved in the review process, not just sort of checking the box around community engagement. Again, some areas of potential areas of improvement where I'm happy to submit specific language.
Yes, please do, because there never was an attempt to take away input. In fact, especially during COVID, there's so many more opportunities for outreach and education, maybe online. The field of outreach and education has really accelerated in the last few years. So yeah, if you have more details, you'll also notice the absence of the mention of trying to tinker with SEAKR. Internally, frankly, we just felt that if a project was clean and green and equitable and sustainable, it should survive SEAKR review. So there, the effort that would go into changing SEAKR, which could be multi-year and very controversial, may not be worth that effort. We could probably address that by ensuring that these projects that we want to expedite are truly, green, equitable, and sustainable. And again, these are things that have worked. I've been talking to developers and municipal officials for years, and these are our panel more than I think any other panel is based on in reality, things that have worked in the field. Okay, land use four, please.
Paul, can I ask one other quick question on this?
Of course.
Thank you. Which is, this is another question that we've discussed in the past. How do we deal with definition of disadvantaged communities that is not ready yet? And how do we make sure that the high priority areas, which in my mind are sort of like the framework in which, this accelerated review process is going to be embedded in, is something that I think still needs to be addressed explicitly in terms of whether those high priority areas are going to be defined through the community that live and work there, and vis-a-vis the disadvantaged communities framework, but also how are we integrating the latest science coming from on the mitigation side and on the adaptation side to define where are we trying to achieve the highest impact, and how are we evaluating, more importantly, the effect of these the impact of these projects in terms of achieving the carbon emission reduction goals. And so I'm wondering if you think that this is the right place to think about how are we using data to identify those high priority areas, or whether you think that it's another recommendation that where that might be more better suited for that.
I could ask the panel. I could turn that out over to the panel if anyone has anything to say. I have some thoughts on it, but.
Well, may I just ask a quick question? And I apologize. I've been on and off I don't know what happened. My computer, just one of those things. So I'm sorry, Juan, I missed most of what you said, the initial comment, but by high priority areas, do you mean sort of, I think has been defined in here as sort of the development areas and the conservation areas, that sort of framework of sort of, my understanding is what is the idea is those would be defined by the community itself. That's not something sort of that would be a state, although a state defined, although certain criteria may be available. I think the actual identification would not be, you know, sort of a state function, because that's pretty top down in a home rule state, you know. But perhaps that's something that we could define a little bit better. But I think the goal really is sort of give the communities, you know, the sort of empower communities to determine within certain criteria, this is where we want to see development, this is where we don't, and it sort of sets the stage for then when development comes in, it's what the community wants, sort of similar to the ball model, you know, I mean, not to get too technical, but, you know, sort of this is what we want. And then there's, you know, it sort of facilitates within the smart, you know, the sort of smart growth sort of framework. I don't know if that helps. And I'm sorry if I'm totally off base because I missed most of what was said.
No, thank you, Sarah. I think that's it's really great to hear. What you're hearing on my end is just a little bit of excitement, because I think that particular opportunity, like thinking about how do we make sure that there's some type of criteria that is both connecting kind of like what we know in terms of the goals, mm-hmm. where we know in terms of where the emission targets are, and where we ultimately are going to be able to see whether this is working at a regional but also at a statewide scale, connects with what the local communities are, you know, are stating that they want to prioritize on the mitigation side. And then on the adaptation side, you know, something that I was very excited from Lamarck's last presentation, which I think is a really good opportunity to connect the two together, mm-hmm. is that the proposed adaptation plan does speak about high priority areas on the adaptation side. And what I'm missing, I think, or what I think we can brainstorm around is how to anchor that. I do feel that there's a really good opportunity right now with what the state is developing with the new projections associated with Climate 2.0, and mm-hmm. the fact that they're going to be available for the 12 regions. And so I think that this is a good opportunity to anchor things on that end. And then as the definition of disadvantaged communities gets completed, that could be overlaid and continuously monitored to track the evaluation.
Yeah, I think that makes sense. Great.
Yeah, I think that's ultimately the goal. And Juan, if you have more precise language, it's always welcome. We are going to have to set some criteria because we're trying to build priority development, priority conservation into grant programs. I took a shot at it in that one slide that includes disadvantaged communities and land bank priorities. But you know, certainly all these designations are either made on the county level or on the local level. And ultimately, to build this into zoning, it has to be local and sometimes very micro-local. So the idea is not for the state to do a priority growth conservation plan, but to help localities do it and give them some broad framework criteria.
A quick follow-up question. Do we know when the... I think that actually we do know that the actual definition of disadvantaged communities will not be ready for a while. That's going to... It sounds like it has like a longer timeline. Right. But how do we... I think that in the final iteration of the recommendations, we should be able to incorporate some of that language. And I'm wondering if, like, not now, because it's not going to be ready now. But what is the opportunity to make sure that ultimately, when these recommendations get, you know, framed in the context of the actual plan, do we have to actually finish that part so that it's not left out for interpretation, and we make sure that this is really focusing on those communities and not others?
Yeah, I think they're in the scoping process, because, you know, this process doesn't end when we present our recommendations to the Climate Action Council. We're specifically empowered to continue to talk with the panel members and others to get to the details. It's a tightrope that we've walked here between not enough details and too much details prior to scoping. But, you know, you'll all be engaged as much as you'd like, even after we present the recommendations.
Thank you. I appreciate that.
Okay, land use 4. Align state funding priorities. Again, next slide. It's kind of a repetitive theme, but here we get into some statutory changes. We think that we can play around with the Smart Growth Public Infrastructure Act to reflect many of these themes and recommendations and strategies. Statutorily, the Infrastructure Act, as its name implies, relates to infrastructure funding. It's a weak statute. We'd like to strengthen it. We'd also like to extend it to beyond infrastructure projects, and also to encompass planning grants. We did not include that in the initial legislation. I still can't figure out why, even though I was at the table drafting it. But we'd like to extend the application of smart growth review and funding to as many areas as we can in state government. One way we put in the component here, one way to do it is to actually use the smart growth review to grade applications. And if they meet a certain threshold, a paragon of smart, equitable growth, we can feed that out to our network of agencies and somehow prioritize those projects, bundle resources around those projects. Next slide, please. All right, here's one we added. Number one, we all agreed that RESTORE and the Environmental Restoration Program are tremendous sources of support, particularly for distressed, blighted, disinvested communities. RESTORE in particular is not a dependable and regular source of funding, so we're suggesting that maybe it be that. The second component is trying to build off of what Housing and Community Renewal already designate as a priority housing goal, and that's TOD and workforce housing. So expanding the kind of the lantern that they have focused on TOD and affordable housing. One project, the crown jewel of housing assistance, the 9% low-income housing tax credit, already incorporates that, but we'd like to expand those concepts out. Similarly, the Brownfield Opportunity Area Program, in my opinion, has been the exemplar of smart growth, balancing the three E's, integrating the three E's. There already is priority and preference funding. I think we need to implement that, underscore it more, but also a apply that notion that BOAs should receive priority funding to as many relevant programs as possible. I will stop there. Any comments?
If there are no other comments, I want to say thank you for highlighting the BOAs. I'm very excited to see that. Thank you so much for that. But I think that, you know, that's a perfect example where I think that the smart growth, the definition of smart growth for BOAs, absolutely yes. But for environmental justice communities, I think that addressing, for example, air quality issues that are not carbon may need a specific kind of like a sort of like language that says, you know, this is either part of the definition of smart growth or is actually separate, but can also be achieved. And so, you know, in this list, you know, I think that there's room, for example, to consider whether the coastal zone management program, for example, be adjusted using the COCPA mandate to reflect equity and climate, you know, priorities. To, for example, require the reduction of diesel truck traffic in places where maritime and rail should be prioritized, which, you know, could go to the same sort of in the same direction, may be related with smart growth, but are entirely, I think, different in the sense that they're focusing also at these other types of benefits that are priority in environmental justice communities.
Yeah, Juan, I know we're talking more extensively about that in on the transportation panel. And in fact, they're doing an entire roundtable on freight. I'm sure they're going to address this topic. I can distribute an invitation to that roundtable because it's a very real concern, air quality around areas with high truck traffic and truck idling. And proximity to ports is something they've taken up pretty extensively. From a land use perspective, I'm not sure how we get there, but we certainly, with every recommendation we do, we'll be doing a deep dive into the health impacts, especially the health disparities impacts.
I'm happy to make suggestions in terms of how to incorporate these ideas into the type of comprehensive planning that is being suggested.
You know, I
can think of specific recommendations, for example, that could require the community, the coastal management zone program, to actually require updates of the WRPs to reflect CLCPA goals, to particularly encourage that type of investment. So that's a low hanging fruit. But I also can think of other ways in which. I know we've talked about the California green zones as examples where comprehensive planning can be used to engage communities and to elevate local priorities and find mechanisms to fund projects and recommendations, like for example, the BOAs, which may already be in place.
Yeah, that's a good idea. And we have somewhere in here, one of the slides, we've also in LWRP made health impact analyses and eligible funding activity. So that's, I would personally like to see more of an health impacts analysis built into the planning process before you get to projects, really. But yeah, we can take a look at that.
Thank you.
Okay, I'm running a little over time. Forgive me. But I did want to get to...
Oh, I said you get a little extra time.
I get
and you've only got one more, so you're...
So TOD, it's a major policy priority going back to the 2015 State Energy Plan. It was called out as the most energy-efficient form of smart growth. The opportunities for equity and affordability, I think, are more present when you do a focused TOD. We have an interagency working group that came out of the energy plan that has been trying to crack this code here for a few years now. And like I said, the transportation panel and this panel had TOD peppered throughout, and we felt like it warranted its own attention. There's also a TOD-related proposal in the 2021 State of the State policy book. So with that in mind, and we've already talked about some of the case studies, New Rochelle, Westbury, Wyandanch is probably maybe the most equitable TOD in the country, and I could safely say that. So we know it works. We know the opportunities there. How can we focus our recommendations specifically on TOD? So next slide. Of course, supporting TOD district plans and zoning with certain criteria built in, green, sustainable, equitable, just transition principles that we're developing through this CLCPA process. Again, going back to the Smart Growth Public Infrastructure Act, TOD would certainly be a priority development area. So we could also reinforce that in state law. Next slide, please. Enhanced subsidies for TOD. And again, here we get to a little repetitive, but I think it's worth repeating that Housing and Community Renewal has set the standard here for highlighting TOD, and there's a tremendous link, of course, there to affordable housing and deconcentrating poverty and preventing or at least dampening displacement and gentrification. Tax credits. There are plenty of tax credits out there that could embrace TOD more specifically, like the Brownfield Cleanup Tax Credit, the BOA Bump Up Tax Credit. We should certainly look at tax policy. The GEIS proposal has worked around TOD. So again, that's a little bit repetitive. So the next two components seem incongruous, but they really aren't. And hopefully I could explain why. We would like to see municipalities incentivize them, support them when they build lower parking minimums into their zoning. Less cars, especially around TOD, in many cases you reduce the need for two cars in a household, and we just don't want oceans of parking taking up prime redevelopment land. So it's in the municipality's hands. How do we support and incentivize that to reduce car dependence and parking dependence? Now, next slide, we are saying facilitate support for structured vertical parking to achieve the desired density. So we want less parking, and I'm saying here we want sort of more parking, but what we really want, and we see this on Long Island and lower downstate, New York City metro area, is a need for dense vertical parking to get to the density you need to attract residents to ideally high density residential units, housing. We've seen this play out in a number of TODs on Long Island. To get to a certain level of density, you need a certain amount of parking. Ideally, that goes up rather than sprawls outward. That's a tough one. They're very, very expensive. We think it's worth highlighting. I just don't know how we would fund it. Or who would fund it, but there is a need for this, we know, through our experience. And the final, this is a, really came from the transportation panel. We're hearing over and over again that the transit agencies want to be more involved early in project review, especially project review that will implicate transit ridership. So there are plenty of case studies out there where the agencies actually have a relationship with planners and they do communicate regularly and early. But that's the exception, not the rule. So we recommend here that there just be more early communication between entities that have a lot to do with one another, but I operate in separate realms. And I think that's it. Yeah. So you'll see some of these are, we've heard before and some of them are new, but this bundle is new. So have at it. By the way, with TOD, we're not just talking about the MTA service area anymore. Buffalo is a model for light rail upstate. Centro and Syracuse, CDTA and Albany have all been integrally involved in planning and zoning to create this alignment that we're looking for. And ultimately, let me put this in its context. I'll finish with this. Ultimately, we are playing into the transportation panel's goal strategy of doubling public transportation access and services upstate by 2035 and significantly expanding services in the MTA area by 2035. So here we have just a tremendous chance to expand public transportation, but also to align land use and smart growth goals around public transportation. Otherwise, it's not accessible, proximate, and it's not easy to use.
And I want to let Juan know I cede all my time to him because I tend to dominate on the natural resources side. So I'll let Juan take my time when it comes to smart growth.
Thank you. I don't mean to hold us back.
No, not at all. Sarah just gave us an indefinite time frame here. So.
Oh, no. How about another five minutes?
Oh, you didn't say indefinite? Okay.
I didn't say indefinite, but this is why we're doing this. This is incredibly helpful, and I do think we need to follow up. And Juan, we definitely welcome your language and suggestions. I think that's going to be incredible. I mean, this comes from the panel, so we want to make sure it reflects everyone's priorities.
Thanks so much. Are there other members of the panel that have questions, comments? Thank you, Kathy. That was very generous.
I can speak on behalf of one panel member, which is Gita, not to say anything specific. She did say she has a few comments, but she had serious technical difficulties and was unable to get on, so she'll share them with everyone afterwards. Just want to pass.
I can share my comments in later, but just the overview is, and kind of like echoing some of the comments in the chat about the different aspects or the different implications of the definition or the timeline of the definition of disadvantaged communities. It sounds to me that this recommendation sort of lends itself also to think about disadvantaged communities in different ways. So one is, of course, who lives and works there, but also as it relates to the land use aspect of it. There's an interesting opportunity that is highlighted in one of the comments in the chat, which I think could be interesting to think about from the land use perspective, because I really like, Paul, how you're saying, well, this is particularly connected and being developed with another panel, the transportation panel. But I think that there are important opportunities to anticipate how will the transit-oriented development investment be captured in terms of, or could be harnessed in terms of economic development opportunities, which have to do with land use. So for example, how are we planning or how is the framework encouraging communities to think about where will the sort of services and goods that will be required to build some of the improvements going to be coming from? I think that, again, going back to the definition of smart growth, I'm very eager to understand how can our recommendation here begin to highlight or incentivize a comprehensive planning that is thinking about that. In communities where commercial and residential development is allowed, great, which I think is sort of in my understanding of how the smart growth definition is really sort of encompassing. But in industrial waterfront communities where industrial development can also be planned to be equitable, like in places where the environmental justice movement, for example, has been thinking about how to position these places as infrastructure hubs and manufacturing hubs to build the workforce and the type of a infrastructure to produce goods and services, not just to equip and build transit-oriented development related interventions or projects, but also just in terms of retrofitting buildings to address some of the other big emission reduction strategies that are being discussed in some of the other panels. So So I think that I wonder if this is also if there's an opportunity here to re-embed the transit-oriented development into a comprehensive planning framework that is thinking about all these different types of communities, not just places where commercial and residential uses can coexist, but actually places that are zoned for industrial and manufacturing that can still function as industrial and manufacturing. I'm thinking what working waterfronts, where there could be other benefits associated with maritime, et cetera, places where we could require thinking about these things and where specific incentives can be deployed to elevate these priorities.
Yeah, I think that's ultimately the goal. One, and you know, one of the things we have to remember here, especially with transit, planning around transit, is that it's very different in Albany or Westchester County or Buffalo. It's a very different concept than a rural area that also must rely on transit, but in many cases doesn't have the critical mass to support, you know, high levels of transit service. So, you know, we have to, and I've been spending a lot of time with the public transit agencies trying to figure that one out too. So to some extent, you know, there definitely is no one size fits all. There's got to be a middle ground between that and trying to get to each community type. Somewhere in between, I think we can embed these criteria. And again, it starts with the planning process.
Great. Thank you.
Let's definitely have some follow up on your input, and you know, I think specific language would be incredibly helpful. So if we could follow up with that in the next couple of days, that'd be awesome. I think we are tight on time, Paul. That was your last. That's it. The next we move to clean energy, correct?
Yep, that's it. Yes.
If anything else comes up, you know, if panel members have thoughts that, you know, feel free to obviously throw them in the chat, or if you think of something right afterwards, just, you know, we definitely can follow up after this. All right. So thank you, Paul. Let's move on to Brad. Can you take over for clean energy?
Absolutely.
Thank you.
So let me just start by saying, you know, thank you to the panelists. You have been very intimately involved in the development of all these recommendations. Many of them come directly from your contributions, but also all the stakeholders that have been involved providing comments, being engaged. You know, we've had these public local official panels. Josh explained a lot of the different outreach and engagement efforts that we've undertaken. And all of this, it was an effort to try to compile these ideas and to kind of categorize them and kind of put them into a format that you know, would get us kind of concisely to a few recommendations that really get at the spirit and the specifics of what you wanted to achieve. So that is what you'll see reflected here in these recommendations. So next slide. So we've got three slides here with like six different initiatives. What I will just say is that, you know, these six recommendations are really geared towards achieving a number of benefits and impacts. And so I'm just going to kind of start off by saying, you know, much of this is about generating economic benefits for communities. I think it's fair to say that, you know, local government officials especially, you know, they want their communities to benefit from the new clean energy economy. But they do struggle with, you know, tight budgets and limited staff resources, and anything that the state can do to help those local governments achieve those objectives is I think a welcome step forward. And in terms of the economic benefits to communities, much of what we'll be discussing in these strategies achieve is savings on energy bills, right? And that's money that can be reinvested in communities, money that's put back into the pocketbook of ratepayers and taxpayers. Municipal governments can save money in their municipal budgets by saving energy. And these can help contain the cost of government and speed the fiscal recovery, especially in this post-COVID environment. Every dollar counts in terms of the savings, but they're also generating lots of jobs and investment. And, you know, clean energy is about attracting and retaining business establishments in local communities throughout the state. There's like 164,000 jobs in the clean energy sector in New York State today. It's one of the fastest growing job categories in the country. So the extent that local governments and communities can benefit from these kind of mega trends of the new clean energy economy, you know, that's really what these strategies are geared towards achieving. But in terms of disadvantaged communities, you know, specifically, you know, attracting this investment, creating these jobs, and making sure these benefits are achieved in disadvantaged communities specifically, which is, you know, definitely the mandate of the CLCPA, this is going to be a matter of integrating disadvantaged communities into every program and making sure that that's front and center. And we're already seeing progress on that front in a number of state agency programs. And I can speak for at NYSERDA, you know, we're already on the ground promoting projects to happen in disadvantaged communities across the state. And part of the benefit here is, you know, reducing emissions from combustion. You know, we talked about truck diesel emissions. You know, there's emissions that happen from transportation. There's emissions that happen from heating fuels being combusted in buildings. Many of these strategies will have the effect of direct air quality benefits in disadvantaged communities and the resulting health benefits. We're really talking about creating healthier communities. And a lot of what Paul talked about with these land use recommendations, creating really like high quality environments around the smart growth principles, it's a lot about creating healthy communities. So they're very much linked to these kind of walkable, bike friendly communities. So those are some of the benefits, but next slide. So here's strategy three and four. We'll go into more detail on these in the following slides. Next slide. And then five and six. So let's just dive right into it, and I will quickly run through these and see if you have any comments. I'm going to pause after each one of these, and we can get into it. So why don't we go right to the next slide? So here we're talking about developing this kind of data dashboard. We've talked about this a number of times, and you guys have provided really a great amount of input into formulating what this is all about. You've said to us that local governments have tried to put together community carbon footprints, but also carbon footprints of their own government operations, you know, going back a decade. And it's always been a difficult exercise. And especially small resource constrained communities, you really have a hard time pulling together the data they need in order to make smart, informed decisions about the best and most effective ways to reduce their carbon footprint. So what this is suggesting is that the state sort of step in, develop the kind of data that is needed to develop these kind of carbon footprint, you know, pie charts, analysis, putting kind of information in a user-friendly format that perhaps like you could pick your community name from a drop-down menu and it would produce for you like a brief report about your community's carbon footprint. In order to do this, you know, we need the data. So what these components really speak to is the data reporting protocols, looking at the methods for estimating greenhouse gas emissions of transportation at the county, city, town, and village level. And just a quick point on that, our colleagues at Department of Transportation, you know, that's a very interesting idea. You know, there's a lot of different ways to get at this greenhouse gas emissions of transportation. And now with the new information technology and Google is involved in this space and people, you know, have all this data around where their phones go and how fast they go, and they can start to extract a lot of interesting information about how energy is used in transportation. So that's an important part of what we're suggesting here. And then also just to have a launch and maintain a dashboard that's accessible to all communities, that's going to track also different equity concerns, really be a useful tool that local governments can use to track progress over time, to make informed decisions moving forward. So that's strategy number one. Let me stop there and see if you have any comments. Okay, great. Next slide.
I have a quick question, sorry.
Sure.
Do you think that the, it sounds like the audience for the dashboard is different from the audience that we were discussing a minute ago for the type of clearinghouse that will include the maps and data on the land use side? But I'm wondering, you know, what is the vision on, or how could these be integrated to create a little bit of like a, you know, one-stop shop for all these digital resources that maybe could be connected if not hosted in the same place? What is the vision for that?
Yeah, I think that's a great point, Juan. And there's different sort of technical solutions, whether those are tabs in a single dashboard. I think that there's some amount of development that needs to go into figuring out how best to integrate them. But I hear your point, because, you know, we're going to talk about in a minute the idea of mapping with respect to like clean energy siting, and, you know, there's a lot of different data points, you know, especially in this day and age. I mean, there's so much data, and if we can harness it, not be overwhelmed by an ocean of data where we're kind of drowning, but to actually take the data that exists and put it into useful information, there are different categories, right? I mean, when you're doing clean energy siting, that's a different exercise than smart growth planning. That's a different exercise than, you know, maybe local climate action planning. But they do all relate to similar objectives and goals. The thing about the greenhouse gas emissions inventories in this particular dashboard is that it does try to take, you know, the large picture of how are we doing, you know, not only as the state, but from the perspective in a local government jurisdiction, right? There's no part of New York State that's not in a local government jurisdiction. So all the parts have a carbon footprint. And what is that? And how are we doing over time? How can we empower the local decision makers to make a difference so that that carbon footprint is being reduced towards our objectives? So I don't have an answer necessarily, Juan, but it's something that let's try to integrate into the strategy and figure out a way to make this all interoperable.
Great, thank you. I definitely have ideas in terms of how to integrate the resources, understanding that planning for clean energy siting is different, but at the end of the day, it should be very much connected to the comprehensive planning strategy that we were discussing earlier. So thank you for that.
Okay, next slide. So this strategy is about local policy. So encouraging local governments to adopt policies at the local level, like New York Stretch Energy Code, but also things like enhanced code enforcement programs, PACE financing, so let's go to the next slide. We've got these great programs, clean energy communities, climate smart communities. They work very closely together. In many ways, they're fully integrated. Even our coordinator networks are a team approach to helping local governments access the resources available at the state. These programs may appeal to different segments of the sort of local government market, if you will. But they are extremely effective at nudging local governments to take action at the local level on climate change. And it's not limited to just the program that we have on the street today. It's really anything we are trying to get local governments to try to consider and to implement. We can use these program designs to help to get there from here. So expanding those programs, continuing to expand NYPA's clean energy services to reach more communities, expanding these regional coordinator networks, and providing that critical assistance. Because, again, the keys to success with these programs are not only are we providing very clear guidance about what local governments should do, we're also supporting them with technical assistance resources, actual people that live in the regions that they serve, right? And so that's clear guidance, technical assistance, also grants and recognition, all right? If we can combine all four of those elements, we have a winning strategy for, building awareness, getting consideration, building implementation into the sort of the fabric of what it means to be a local government, not a satellite effort that, is kind of like out there, like, oh, maybe we're interested in climate action, maybe we're not, but to make it a core function of local government, these programs help to make that happen. Next slide. Maybe I should stop there and ask, does anybody have any comments about strategy two? Okay, next slide. So, and there's a series of statewide policies that would promote consistent advancement of the kind of building decarbonization, these critical objectives, looking at aligning the state's energy code with CLCPA goals, establishing energy benchmarking and performance standards for buildings, creating innovative public benefit financing mechanisms. These are meant to create consistency and alignment across communities in New York State. Many of these things have a sort of a local government aspect to them, but it's important, instead of a patchwork of different policies in different communities, which may be taking a very different approach programmatically or policy-wise to what they're trying to achieve, trying to create consistency across the board. That puts all communities on sort of a level playing field and none at a competitive disadvantage to any other community. So that's an important concept that we heard from our stakeholders, to create that kind of across-the-board alignment. Next slide. So again, benchmarking, performance standards, alignment of energy code, updating the energy law, providing funding for administrative costs of code updates. I mean, this is something that we heard loud and clear. There is the need for assistance with respect to code books, guidance documents, training for all kinds of stakeholders, not just code enforcement officers, but the whole range of kind of building industry professionals and other stakeholders. And then this notion of, okay, if we have decarbonization requirements or standards, how can those be financed through, something similar to, New York State's clean water financing model? So that's strategy number three. Any comments? Okay, next slide. And then planning support. This is really about how do we facilitate and promote clean energy, expanding equitable access, maximizing the local benefits and resiliency, minimizing environmental impacts through planning support. So there's a whole number of strategies that we can employ here to help facilitate this, but there are a number of opportunities. So let's just go to the next slide. Model local laws. This is providing language that local governments can consider in developing their own local legislation to anticipate and plan for development of solar and other renewable energy technologies, including battery storage at the local level. Again, it helps to have model language as a starting point to consider when developing these kinds of local laws and development regulations. Promoting things like streamlined permitting for solar, the New York State Unified Solar Permit. There are other streamlining that could be done for other clean energy technologies, including energy storage. So this really relates to the kind of energy, the code enforcement realm, but streamlining those processes can help not only the applicant get in and out of the building department quicker, but it can help the building department process this kind of all these new technologies and all this volume that is coming through the door on clean energy related projects. Mapping tools. I mean, this has been critical. We've heard about the really, it's, you know, kind of awe-inspiring work of like the Long Island Solar Mapping Project, the Scenic Hudson mapping, putting the information so that you could do a kind of a comprehensive evaluation to understand what the potential for clean energy development is, but also minimizing impacts on lands and other high quality soils, other competing uses, putting that those mappings mapping together is critical. But also providing the kind of technical and financial support that communities need to plan for and review solar projects. So that's the final component of strategy number four. Any comments here? All right.
Brad, yes. This is Ed. I'm just noting on the third bullet there where it talks about high quality, minimize impacts on high quality soils. There's a lot of other land resources impacts that need to be minimized as well. And we might want to just expand that on resources and lands with high quality soils. Certainly forests are an important critical component. There's been recent New York Times editorials about that, of forests being felled for solar. So might want to just be more general in the language there.
Okay. Thanks, Ed. We'll certainly do that. Okay. Next slide. Local governments have a critical role to play in connecting their constituents to clean energy products and services. So this comes, community choice aggregation, microgrids, district systems, there's workforce development initiatives, community scale campaigns. We're seeing a tremendous explosion of interest in this in these kinds of strategies. Being active and visible in your community, connecting constituents with clean energy products and services. Next slide. So CCA, specifically this notion of enrolling customers. So, CCA is where local governments choose essentially where the energy comes from for their community. And if they want renewable energy, 100% renewable, they can use CCA to help make that happen. But what's really an exciting development is where participants are automatically enrolled into community solar projects. So they're helping to drive the development of new renewable energy in New York State. So that's what that first bullet is all about. We have been encouraged to include this recommendation to allow county governments to authorize and form CCA programs with a local opt-out. We want to promote community scale campaigns. We want to expand workforce development programs with specific job placement focus in the clean energy and emerging technology sectors. And then also to enable the development of more microgrids and district clean energy systems. Any comments? Okay, and then finally, these are the local assets. Okay, so what are the energy consuming assets that are controlled not only by local governments, but all related public entities like school districts, like IDAs, but there's a whole range of parking authorities and wastewater treatment districts and authorities. I know on Long Island, there's even a Memorial Day parade district. I mean, there are lots of different special purpose governments and we can't ignore them. And so this really speaks to that there are a lot of energy consuming assets. So let's focus on high impact actions like LED lighting, energy efficiency upgrades, heat pump projects. There's a tremendous number of opportunity with fleet electrification, especially with respect to school buses. Next slide. Okay, so technical support, helping local governments actually implement clean energy projects, evaluating options for reducing the internet connection costs of municipal priority sites, and really doing a lot more to identify how can we interconnect projects that make the most sense within the local planning context. So that's also a focus. Prioritizing funding for projects that recover methane from wastewater treatment and landfills for energy production. Because local governments control and own these facilities, there are tremendous opportunities, many of which are being taken advantage of, but not nearly enough to sort of reduce that, that methane. But developing tools and resources to help municipalities procure energy and do so in a green, you know, with green renewable energy, supporting electrification of municipal and school district fleets, encouraging the tracking and reporting of energy use for municipal facilities, and increasing waste reduction and recycling. So that's the final strategy. It really relates to local energy consuming assets. Any comments?
Yes, I have a comment. A question. So this is really, really exciting because it's kind of like where the subcommittee is sort of beginning to connect to with the outside world in a way. It's kind of like beginning to be. Yeah, this is where I've seen the clean energy recommendations be the most comprehensive, and that's really exciting. I wonder two questions. One is this a good place where or how are you thinking about what that other subgroup is thinking around the redevelopment of a energy production sites and so that's one question. And more broadly, or I think what that question is going is, how can we reintegrate some of these recommendations that are land use with what's happening on the other end so that we sort of like reconnect them in a way where we're sort of bringing back a little bit where you've landed here. For example, how can we make sure that the recommendations that are geared here toward a clean energy can also result in resilient energy systems, microgrids that use clean energy on the other end, as we think about some of the land use recommendations to in some of the EGRs, as we were discussing earlier with the expanded definition of smart growth. So how can we, those are the two questions, like how are we connecting with the specific plans to decommission and redevelop former power plants to how are you thinking about reconnecting some of these in the larger comprehensive planning framework?
So the just transition and the energy sources. So that's a good question. Maybe I'll ask Sarah for help on this. But I would say that these just transition issues are they're, I don't want to say they're limited to specific communities, but many of the clean energy strategies we're discussing are applicable across the board. So I think that there's like a need programmatically to kind of make a little bit of a differentiation. But certainly we are looking at applying the same strategies in just transition communities, but perhaps at a larger scale. Sarah, did you want to say anything on this?
No, I think that's exactly it. It's sort of there is a connection there implied. I mean, that the just transition subgroup that's talking about decommissioned power plants, that's sort of very specific, geographically limited, recommendation, but it's very specific in detail talking about, how can we help these communities? How can we help the areas that are again, Juan, I'll go back to BOA because I love BOA, but it is, it's sort of that model of how do we take these communities that have been impacted by these power plants and ensure that they continue to have, to benefit from the site without, and sort of also address the sort of both, the environmental and health issues that that sort of remained, that maybe impacted them before and remain. So I think that approach is reflected, are intended to be sort of reflected more broadly, as Brad said, sort of throughout these recommendations. I'm not, I mean, perhaps there's a way that we can tie that in a little bit better, maybe just by tweaking some language. We have asked the, you know, we have had the Just Transitions group review these recommendations, and we can talk to them again about sort of more specifically, you know, is there anything that we need to do to sort of make sure that we're tying these things together and that we're integrating? I don't know if that helps at all.
No, thank you. That's very helpful. And I love the references to the BOA program. In my mind, you know, it's kind of like really recognizing local leadership, grassroots leadership in terms of creating a vision for redevelopment that addresses local priorities, local community priorities, but also engages the public and private sector in that redevelopment process in a way where equity and justice can actually be achieved. Mm-hmm. They're not necessarily mutually exclusive. I wonder if this is an opportunity to think about shared ownership. Like, what are the mechanisms? What are the economic development opportunities associated with these infrastructure improvements? So thinking about the electrification related recommendations, where are the stations going to be located? The charging stations going to be located? Where are the parts that are going to be associated with those charging stations going to be manufactured? And how can communities plan to position themselves on different aspects of the supply chain and the planning process to get to where those are going to be, you know, located? So in my mind, that's one way to connect it substantively to the land use planning process. But I think that here, there's also an interesting opportunity to think about what are the financial vehicles and the ownership models that the recommendation can be encouraging local municipalities, but also communities to consider in terms of the type of entrepreneurship that could be encouraged with these types of investments. So I know that, for example, Uprose and Sunset Park has created, I think we talked about this, the community solar, so right, yeah, a community cooperative that is actually engaging directly in co-ownership of the infrastructure and is benefiting from that type of economic development, distributing the wealth across the community. But I think that something similar could happen in and around the electrification process in terms of, you know, where are these services, where are these amenities or these assets going to be built? And certainly something interesting also in terms of some of the other infrastructure improvements that you're talking about. You know, there's a question in the chat that I thought was really interesting, which was, okay, so my energy bill keeps going up. How come? For the same amount of electricity. And, you know, one of the questions that I've heard people raise is, building on that is, okay, so as we continue and increase the amount of clean energy resources and particularly distributed resources, you know, the cost of maintaining the central infrastructure system is going to keep going up. And those who can disconnect, those who have access to the roofs and have the capital to invest in these solutions, you know, will be able to go off grid. But those who don't will have to continue connected. So it will be interesting to also anticipate, you know, what are the equity impacts that you hint in some of the previous slides, mm-hmm, to anticipate costs that are going to be exponentially, mm-hmm, higher to maintain the infrastructure.
I think those are incredibly important points that sort of central to, I think, the CLCPA overall. Beyond, you know, I don't pretend to be an expert in interconnection and in local and development of solar or any of this, but you know, I think we can hint at it, we can talk about it in our recommendations. This is but that's sort of the big question, isn't it, that's being sort of, that we need to sort of address beyond this panel and, you know, with as the you know, the Climate Action Council will have to sort of address it in the scoping plan. But it's sort of that ongoing challenge is how do we, and that's why there's the, you know, how do we stay true to the requirement in the CLCPA that this is equitable, that this is implemented in a way that is equitable, that is fair, that benefits the most disadvantaged communities, which again we don't have the full definition for yet, as you know, but at least you know they're working on it, and I think that's sort of the overarching sort of umbrella under which we're functioning. I don't know how much and I'll let Brad speak specifically to the recommendations. Maybe there are some things we can sort of talk about to sort of begin to sort of more pointedly touch on those things. But I think what you're raising is sort of the big. This is sort of the big nut that we have to we have to focus on across the board.
Again, certainly a question that may not have one quick answer, but maybe one way to think about it is. How are the land use strategies and the type of development, the type of smart growth that is being discussed, connect with the clean energy interventions that are specific and targeted in terms of the type of not just a land use potential, but economic development implications toward that? I think that maybe one way to start thinking about it is how do they connect, and perhaps we can take it from there.
I think those are great points, and it's you're challenging us to think comprehensively, holistically, making connections, and I think that probably everybody on this call really appreciates that perspective. I do think that the Just Transition projects really do actually offer an opportunity to sort of pilot, if you will, the kind of scaled up integration of the land use and the clean energy and the resilience all in a kind of comprehensive way specific to these communities affected by the energy sources transition. So, I know that there is work being done at NYSERDA to try to support these communities with a lot of resources to sort of get at that vision. But that's very welcome feedback. So thanks, Juan. And that concludes my section of the presentation, so thank you.
Great. Thank you, Brad. I'm afraid we did go a little over. We've got just 10 minutes to 3, so we have 10 minutes more. I don't know if the panel is willing to give another 10 minutes to give, so we can have maybe 20 minutes to sort of finish up on carbon sequestration. Is that acceptable? I guess why don't we get started and see how quickly we can get through Laura's recommendations. Laura, are you on?
There are some. I'm on.
Okay, great.
And thanks. I can speak quickly. I'll just quickly then first echo the thanks to the panel, the carbon sequestration subgroup, agency staff, and the members of the public who've really been actively offering expertise, very thoughtful review and feedback and suggestions that have helped to develop these recommendations. I've certainly learned a lot from all of you through this process. And I hope that what I'm presenting today reflects your contributions. And if not, obviously this is the time to give us feedback. So I'll be going over the carbon sequestration strategies, which you've seen a lot of the elements of what I'm going to be presenting. But since the last panel presentation, there's been some reorganization, some additional content added to the template slides, a little bit more detail added to these mitigation strategies on wetlands and blue carbon. And then there's an expanded set of components under an enabling strategy that focuses on mapping, research, planning, and assistance, which I'll talk about at the end. And I'll just note that the significant carbon sequestration recommendations are really coming from the Ag and Forestry Advisory Panel, because forests are such an important critical piece of the carbon sequestration strategy. But we're aiming to add to that through land use and conservation of other types of natural areas like wetlands. So there's two mitigation strategies which are on this slide. They're now focusing specifically
on protection, restoration, and monitoring of freshwater wetlands and blue carbon, and all the other related strategies are now in the enabling recommendation at the end of the presentation. So these are, well, let's just get into each one, maybe next slide. So initially, the first mitigation strategy is focused on maintaining, enhancing the sequestration potential of freshwater, non-tidal wetlands in New York State, again, focusing on protection, restoration, and monitoring. So it's really emphasis on legislation, regulation, and land protection. So next slide. And I can just talk a little bit about these components. The components include improving and expanding the ability to regulate all freshwater non-tidal wetlands and adjacent areas that meet criteria, but also by potentially changing the way these wetlands are regulated, and also improving the implementation of the program by updating regs and developing internal and external guidance. Considering wetlands that are no longer protected since the 2020 Navigable Waters Protection Rule changes, and then also thinking about regional permitting improvements that can incentivize the use of natural nature-based features to enhance resilience and ecosystem benefits. And then there's one more slide related to this, if you just go to the next slide. And that's to increase New York State and other investment in the protection, restoration, and monitoring of freshwater non-tidal wetlands and their adjacent areas to maximize carbon sequestration potential, which is, again, the focus of this part of the land use local government work. And so this could be through the different state funding programs, but also other opportunities. So I'm going to pause here in case anybody has any questions or comments before shifting over to the similar recommendations for blue carbon. Okay, next slide. So again, now very similar set of recommendations, but specifically about coastal and estuarine tidal wetlands, submerged aquatic vegetation, and other coastal habitats. Focusing again on protection, restoration, and monitoring. So the local land use piece again will be at the end. So maybe I will go to the next slide. And once again, focusing on improving and expanding regulation of all tidal wetlands and adjacent areas, coastal habitats, coastal erosion hazard areas that meet criteria, and also examining opportunities to improve implementation of the regulatory program by developing internal and external guidance and changes in law and regulation where needed. And then very compatible recommendation from the previous strategy to develop regional permits to incentivize use of natural nature-based features. Next slide, please. And then very much like the freshwater wetlands, to again increase state and other investment in protection, restoration, and monitoring, to include things like migration pathways of tidal wetlands, protection of submerged aquatic vegetation, again to maximize carbon sequestration. So I'm going quickly because it's five to three. But if there's not any questions, I can just move on to the final strategy.
Well, Laura, it's Kathy, and I do have a hard stop at 3. One of the things I worry about, and I understand that these strategies have a low kind of carbon value, but I don't know how to reflect that a lot of these strategies also have an adaptation value, and I know that's what
yes.
work is. But, you know, I'm worried that, like, we send this up to the Climate Action Council, and they're like, oh, look at all this low stuff, and this all goes to the wayside because they're only focused on reducing carbon when there's also other benefits that are tied to climate change. So I don't know if there's a way to mitigate that.
Right. Thank you for that. And, right, we'll certainly talk about that and strategize how it interfaces with Mark's adaptation and resilience recommendations. But you also reminded me that I failed
my assumption of going over what the benefits are prior to leaping right into strategies, because we're not sharing those slides during the presentation. We're emphasizing throughout these slides that the benefits of having biologically healthy wetlands and other natural areas that are addressed by these recommendations not only support biodiversity, or by supporting biodiversity, they are delivering benefits to communities through ecosystem services. So moderation of flooding and other associated risks of flooding, especially in coastal communities, contributions to clean air and water, and climate adaptation, as you pointed out. Also, increased protection and conservation of natural areas provide increased access to open space and nature for all New Yorkers, which after this last year has even elevated more as a priority for a lot of people, and all the associated mental and physical health benefits. And also the benefits of the last strategy about the enabling strategy, really hopefully enhancing that ability for all different communities to participate in local land use by having increased technical and funding assistance. And then throughout all this too is the recognition that we need to assess the potential negative impacts of green gentrification that can come with conservation of natural areas in all different kinds of communities. And then the
If I could just add to what Kathy was saying, looking at the ag and forestry work, they identify a huge gap in sequestration to reach this 2050 goal of net zero carbon economy. And so every bit of it is going to be critical. All their recommendations, I think, only get you halfway to the amount of sequestration that's going to be required by 2050. So I think all of this is really important, even though it looks like incrementally a small piece of the puzzle. If we don't get them all, we don't get to where we have to get to.
Yes, Ed, thanks for making that point. And that's why I think we are being very comprehensive in even, you know, the smaller bits, along with the larger bits that are going to contribute collectively to helping reach that goal. Okay, let's maybe just jump to the next slide, Josh. This is the enabling strategy focusing on mapping, research, planning, and assistance. And so this is to really capture what Ed was just referring to. Getting at carbon sequestration in natural areas in New York State, now moving away from the regulation and the protection, instead focusing on improving our ability to protect these areas by improving mapping, both regulatory and non-regulatory, pursuing research that will help us better understand where we have mitigation potential and where we can prioritize investment to get the most out of carbon sequestration opportunities. Also providing conservation planning guidance, stewardship, and assistance for local governments and landowners. Next slide, please. I think it might be, just for the sake of time, easier if I just jump into the next slide and get into the detailed components. So what we're thinking about here is, again, using the best available technology to update maps, which we know are all pretty much across the boards based on old technology. They're outdated, they're inaccurate. So ensuring that we have accurate maps and that they're publicly available, and that we can incorporate those into some kind of statewide conservation framework that provides guidance. It's not regulatory in any way, but it can continually be updated with current spatial data that includes things like critical ecosystems, landscape connectivity. And then also that framework could provide the basis for prioritizing state funding, providing tax relief, prioritizing land acquisition, and also technical assistance programs to conserve these priority areas. And again, make sure it's publicly accessible, but also that there's outreach and assistance to ensure appropriate use and effective use of the framework to target these priority areas. Next slide, please. Also part of this enabling strategy is assistance to county and local governments to create land use policies, programs, strategies that prioritize and protect these natural areas. And so things like authorization statewide of a Community Preservation Act, providing training and support to use the CARA model local laws, comprehensive planning language, and so forth. Also, along with local land use decision makers and municipal decision makers, we also want to engage and support local landowner incentives and other techniques to get the local landowners involved in conserving and restoring everything from non-tidal and tidal wetlands to forests to increase carbon sequestration through management and stewardship. Next slide, please. And then what I mentioned earlier, funding research, analysis, and monitoring to determine carbon storage and sequestration potential of these different natural areas to really increase our understanding, because the accounting on carbon sequestration for natural areas like wetlands and grasslands is not as well understood as forests. Also develop cost-benefit analysis tools and demonstration projects that can help inform decision-making. And next slide. Finally, I think this is the last slide, is just the idea of creating some kind of green job, career training and opportunities to support just transition by developing conservation and restoration service corps, both for maybe young professionals as well as youth, that could focus on stewardship to help us restore and expand carbon sequestration potential in these different natural area types. So it's 3:04, Sarah. I can end there. That's the final slide. But again, if there's questions, if people want to stay on, I'm not going anywhere.
That was great, Laura. You got right through it. Thank you so much. Sure. Does anyone, go ahead, Ed. I was going to say, does anyone have any final comments? Ed, is that, did you, was that you, Ed? No? Anyone? All right, we do have time. You know, we do welcome. I know we're, you know, aware of time. Some folks had to jump off. So maybe we just end it here. Josh, can you go to the next slide? Next one, please. Just a quick note as to what our next steps are. We'll continue to, in addition to working on adaptation and resilience, we have some upcoming meetings. We will continue to work to integrate some of the comments. I think Juan will, you know, work with Juan on some of his feedback, and we'll really, we'll circulate welcome anyone else with any comments, thoughts. Let's work to really refine these. I think we're in a good place. I hope everyone feels that, and we're very close to consensus with the wordsmithing that we want to do in the next few days. So stay tuned for that. And I just want to thank everyone for participating. I want to thank, in addition to the panel members, really want to thank the local government representatives who joined the roundtable, everyone who's been here with us through this process. Thank you so much for your hard work, your dedication. If anyone has any last things to say, otherwise I'll just say have a wonderful afternoon and happy Earth Month. All right. Thank you all.
Thanks, Sarah.
Thanks, Sarah.
Thank you. Thanks.